and credit to him, he took a step back and apologised. Yeah. But there was a moment where I wanted to pick up the stump and stab him. So my experiences with him has been very niggly.
That's Test cricketer Ed Cowan talking about his run-in with Virat Kohli. It's not even remotely the most interesting thing he says in this interview. He's a pretty interesting guy. Not your sort of standard athlete. An author, a father, husband, Test cricketer, self-confessed foodie wanker. And we tape this podcast between the third and fourth tests of the recent series between Australia and India. And we talked about his achievements, his failures, homework gate, moving to Tassie from Sydney, and the future of cricket, really. I hope you enjoyed listening to this as much as I've enjoyed recording it. This is the Stack Report. Ed, you're our first interview. Does that fill you with a sense of dread, of excitement? Do you think, oh, wow, they couldn't get anyone else?
No, I think the pressure of, you know, you need to make that first impression as a podcast, because if the first one's rubbish, I'm sorry, Patrick, but no one's coming back.
Yeah.
So it's all on my shoulders.
That's the faith I've got in you. I feel like, you know, I'm feeling confident about how this is going to be. Let's start with what's going on in India at the moment. You're a cricket nerd. You must be loving the Test cricket coming out of India.
Phenomenal Test cricket, hasn't it been? So much to talk about here. Where to start?
Just broadly.
Yeah, like, well, I'm loving the revival of Test cricket. I think we forget how good Test cricket can be. We're so caught up in the glitz and glamour of the Big Bash, the dress-up parties of the one-day international. The Test match, when you go into the final two sessions and, you know, the draws are still a possibility and people are saying, can they bat it out? You know, the little nuances that we grew up on that necessarily people have fallen out of love with, it's great to see people talking about Test cricket. And I think there's a whole range of things that have made it such a great series. One is the unpredictability of the wickets. You know, it's not the whack-a pancake where 500 plays, 650 declared. You know, those first two tests, although, you know, they might be deemed of a poor quality, if you miss a ball, you're missing something. You are potentially missing something special. And there aren't many times in Test cricket, maybe when Shane Warne was bowling or Glenn McGrath was bowling, you think, I can't miss a ball here because something special is about to happen. Yeah. You feel about that every ball of the series.
I caught a session the other day that was like 2 wickets and 47 runs for a session, and I felt like Steve Smith had made a really well-compiled single-figure score, and I was just like, what does that tell you about how enthralling this cricket is? No runs are being scored, and I'm just that gripped by it.
Yeah.
You don't like limited overs cricket, really, do you, as a viewer?
I find Big Bash and T20 cricket entertaining. There is an entertainment value that I don't think you can deny. I think one-day cricket, I enjoy from a skill point. I enjoy watching the different skills and the evolution of the skills, but I think if we're being serious, it's a dying format, and the sooner that we realise that, the better for cricket. And I think I'd probably be a little bit alone, you know, saying that, because administrators see that. Great advertising dollars for a whole day's cricket.
And as a broadcaster perspective, from our perspective, you know, talking from a nuts and bolts, it's money, isn't it? Like, content, more games, more ad slots.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
From a player's point of view, they still enjoy playing it, because there's a lot of skill involved in one-day international cricket, and it's kind of that nice, happy medium. But if people aren't going to the game, it just feels like this hollow kind of, you know, mild adventure that you can kind of do without, you know.
I think we'll get on to the sort of future of cricket a little bit later. India's, I'm interested as well, because you played your first test against India. What are they like as opponents? Because they seem pretty niggly.
Yeah, they are. Well, you don't need to be an expert to pick up on the aggravation. I think there's a whole range of different factors at play. You know, I think the BCCI and the power struggle that they've had to run world cricket plays out on the field in relation to how the Indian team don't want to be pushed around by Australians, by the Australian team. And the two, people keep saying, oh, they're friends during the IPL. But when these two countries come and play at each other, and it's tough cricket and it's enthralling cricket, and they're playing for the number ones, you know, the bragging rights of who the best team in the world is, tensions are going to get hot. And they are. Well, there's other factors at play. English isn't... We forget that English isn't their first language.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
And it's very easy to sit back and say, as a player, they're barking something at me that is inappropriate when we don't try and converse with them in Hindi.
Sure.
So there's always going to be niggles around misinterpretations of what's said and what isn't said on the field.
I love that Virat Kohli is a villain too, as well. Like, I think sport is better with a villain. It's sometimes even a pantomime villain. Stuart Broad,
yes.
Virat Kohli. And he's not, to this point, backing it up with his on-field stuff. More often than not, he backs it up. Have you gone head-to-head with Virat? Good bloke, ordinary bloke.
I'm not a huge fan. I'm a huge fan of his cricket, don't get me wrong. He is a phenomenal cricketer. I had a little bit of a run-in that was inappropriate when he toured Australia and the umpire had to intervene. He said something.
Were you getting angry, Ed?
No, he was getting angry. He said something, and why I make the point of lost in translation, he said something that was highly inappropriate. A personal matter that was highly sensitive, highly inappropriate, but he didn't realise that he'd overstepped the mark until the umpire came and said, Vera, that's overstepped the mark. And once that was said, to be fair and credit to him, he took a step back and apologised. Yeah. But there was a moment where I wanted to pick up the stump and stab him. So my experiences with him has been very niggly. I think he's just a highly, highly competitive, very driven, very focused individual. And, you know, the really best, probably most of the best cricketers I've met are a bit like that. You know, you think Kevin Peterson, you think of Virat Kohli. You don't necessarily think of a Ricky Ponting, or a Mike Hussey, really affable, friendly. These guys have just got a copious amount of self-belief, and that plays out in very strange ways. And in Virat's case, it comes out as aggression.
How can he have that level of... that's why I've been fascinated watching. We're three tests in to this point. His level of self-belief when he's failing and he's still taking it up to the Australians like he's been scoring runs. I just think, wow, this guy must just really believe in his ability. Incredible.
His mental skill and mental belief is in a different stratosphere. Mm.
Can you tell us what he said to you, or is it sort of for trouble?
Well, I like keeping things on the field, but I had a very sick mum during one of those series and he said something that was inappropriate.
Yeah. And to his credit, I guess he apologised.
He did, though.
Yeah. Okay.
We shook hands.
Yeah. You've played in India. You've done a bit of time in India. Aside from touring with the test team, you played there for New South Wales on a tour, I think, as well.
Yeah.
What's the experience like playing cricket in India?
Certainly, like nothing you'll ever experience anywhere in the world. As you said, I've had a vastly different experience. New South Wales, played over there. I went on two academy tours to India and then a test tour. And to be from a cultural point of view, the first three were probably the most interesting because you're not under lock and key.
Mm.
You can walk around, as a tourist, if you will. You know, the cultural and sensory overload that is India is in your face, and you can embrace it or you can kind of let it get to you. It's a little bit more sanitized when you're on a test tour.
Mm. In a good way or a bad way?
No, I think in a bad way.
Yeah.
You know, security. And to be fair, there are points in time where it's justified. A bomb went off in Hyderabad 8 days before we were there on the last tour. We weren't allowed to leave the hotel. It felt like Alcatraz. People, snipers on the roof and all kinds of things that you wouldn't believe. They're shutting down roads 14 kilometres to the ground in Hyderabad, and they shut the main road in both directions for us to go to training. You can imagine in a city that size what that would envisage and entail, the chaos that provides. And there we are cruising down the highway, that would usually take an hour and a half and it takes 6 minutes. But so from a test tour point of view, what you take out of it is what happens on the field. You've never seen a more passionate and vocal crowd than what you see in the ground. You're kind of removed out of the ground. You're held in a bit of a bubble. But at the ground, things that come to mind in Chennai, the test we played there was full every day, you know, 30,000 people screaming Dhoni, Dhoni, Dhoni. For, and it sounds like, even when he's not batting, and it sounds like, yeah, sure, for 5 minutes or 6 minutes, but for 7 hours a day whistling Dhoni.
Yeah.
You know, they've got these sort of wolf whistles and the screaming. You go home with an incredible headache, but you sit alone in bed thinking that was phenomenal. Amazing. You know, and he comes out to bat and you see the people racing down the grandstand from the top of the grandstand. You know, and there's a crush as though it's, you know, Justin Bieber or something walking onto the stage. And all these people are crushed against the fence and you're on the field and you kind of feel a bit helpless because you can see people being crushed against the fence as people are pushing to... And all they're trying to do is get closer to their hero.
Yeah.
And it's, you're thinking, what are they doing? This is not making any sense. And it's not until you see these people, you know, potentially harm themselves to get 50 metres closer to their hero that you think they actually believe that he is either a
deity, basically
a god, and it's thrown out there.
Yeah,
where by so many cricketers, they're, oh, those, the Indian cricketers, they're treated like gods.
Similar to when you play at Sydney Uni.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Oh, I get a car park at least. But for until you see it in action, the only word you can describe is how they are treated as gods.
Mm.
There is nothing in our language or that I've seen before as to why anyone would be treated with such aura, and it's phenomenal. So that stays in my mind.
Is it an intimidating place to play? I mean, not physically.
Absolutely.
So yeah, okay,
yeah, absolutely. It's intimidating on a lot of fronts because you're permanently being tested physically, mentally, technically. You know, you have to change things. You're playing at the highest level, you're under pressure, and you're doing things that you never imagined that you'd have to do under such intense scrutiny. You might have to change your technique between test matches because what you're doing isn't working against the off spin, and you need to find it. You've got 4 days to come up with a solution to score some runs, otherwise your career's over as a test cricketer. That's it. That's immense pressure.
You touched on that, and that happened to you over there because you probably had a lean-ish trot for the start, 20s and 30s, and then made an 86 in Mahali, was it?
Yeah.
I'd spent
a lot of time before going over, you know, I played a test match at the SCG against Sri Lanka, and we had a tricky chase on the fourth day, Mike Hussey's last test match, and it was a turning wicket, and there Herath played and another spinner, and I was hopeless.
Pretty good spinners.
Good spinners, but in Australian conditions, a little bit of turn, and I couldn't score. I could not get off strike, and I knew the Indian tour was looming. I thought, if I keep doing what I'm doing, I'm not lasting one test. I might get a game, but I'm certainly not scoring any runs. So I had a little 6 week block where I just had to revamp everything I was doing. I could only pretty much score off the sweep shot, and I thought that's going to be high risk over there. Couldn't defend, getting stuck on the crease, not going forward, not going back.
I read in your book that you said that the way to play spin was you got to go off the back foot, but did you feel that you had to go, it wasn't that simple to just have that strategy in India against the quality of spinners that you were going up against?
Yes and no. I think it was a case of, until you're over there, and even little things like you get over there for 3 weeks before and you train in the nets in Chennai that don't turn 1 centimetre. You're on the concrete nets, or, you know, they're not literally concrete, but they're white, immaculate nets that don't turn, and the Indians are training on the red soil 5 nets over, but you're not allowed to train on them.
So, how do they get away with that?
Oh, they do it. There's a guy standing with a machine gun, minding that no one steps on the nets. You know, like it's just done. So you think you're going fine until the test starts, and then you're under pressure and you realise that the forward defence is in fact the most dangerous shot you can play. You lunge forward, and Ashwin is having you for dinner. He's either drifting it and straightening it onto your pad. If it's turning, you're nicking it. You know, so as you say, playing off the back foot, which is so un-Australian. To play spin off the back foot is almost like conceding defeat.
Mm.
Now here we charge down the wicket, power through the line, hit him over the top, hit him where you want.
Mm.
But, you know, that concession to say, I'm going to actually let him bowl where he wants to bowl, and I'm going to react to what he's doing rather than dominating where he's going to bowl, is very un-Australian. But once you're there, you realise that that's pretty much the only way you can survive for long periods of time. We saw Pete Hanscom play beautifully the other night, doing exactly that, deep in his crease, playing, and not just playing off the back foot, but how he's playing off the back foot, not with a high back lift, staying low, very punchy. You know, even if you, we saw Mitch Marsh try and play off the back foot, but he picked his bat up to try and play a cut shot, and he's LBW before he knows it. So there's obviously nuances involved in even executing that game plan. It's fine to say, I want to play him off the back foot, but how? How are you going to do that? Make sure that you can limit risk, but also put some pressure on him by scoring.
86, that 86 came off 223 deliveries. How frustrating was it to fall just short of 100? How much enjoyment and satisfaction did you get from that innings? Because I imagine it doesn't come any tougher than those conditions.
Yeah. Well, to be honest, looking back, I think the second innings in Hyderabad, I think I got 46 off probably 200 balls as well. You know, and that was probably a more satisfying innings because it was, you know, the last innings of the test, where the 86 was the first innings of the game. To be honest, it was pretty, as far as India goes, it was pretty good batting conditions. But I remember just thinking, geez, I've really missed an opportunity to get another test 100 here, because I think I batted for 5 hours, had them at the mercy. Dave Warner had played well as well, would set up the day. And then it just got harder and harder and harder. I think we only got...
Mentally,
physically, it was hot. Ashwin felt like we're on top of him, and then he came, you know, he's like the ultimate nemesis. He sort of came back.
He looks like the guy from Accounts. It's kind of weird that he's, you know, well, he's so fearsome.
It's a great reference because he's the loveliest human you could ever meet.
Yeah.
And yet, with a ball in his hand, he bowls these spitting cobras and has such beautiful subtleties of the wrist to change how the ball talks for him. But a beautiful human, as you say, you know, he when he does have his glasses on, he does look like the guy in payroll.
Yeah.
That innings, Mahali, I think more than anything, just it gave me great resolve that what I was doing was working, and that I could be, more than any innings that I played in Test cricket, that I could be a Test cricketer for a really long time. I think more so than the 100 at the Gabba in our conditions. I always felt the biggest test was overseas, where I had a really tough tour of the West Indies in tough conditions when a lot of the batsmen struggled. And then India was my second overseas tour. So that, it was kind of that innings I thought, you know what, I've kind of now got a technique that I can take to the subcontinent, know it's going to work against the best spinners. And that was maybe a little inflection point where I thought I could actually do this for a few years. And then, of course, I think it ended up being my third last test, and the dream's over. So it's interesting how the world pans out.
Well, we'll get to that sort of, because it was the Ashes, it was your last test, was that?
First test of the Ashes, yeah.
First test of the Ashes. We'll get to that in a moment. But I wanted to ask you as well, that tour of India, there's a fair bit happening off the pitch.
Oof.
Tell me what
you've done your homework.
Well, tell me about your recollections of homework game.
Wow. Yeah.
What? How do you reflect back on it? I mean, I know it's a massive story.
It is a massive story, and I don't want to... I'm happy reflecting upon it without trying to create...
Headlines.
Any further headline. How I remember it was the team needed something. And I'm a bit of a traditionalist in that if your boss, whether... You know, I've had other jobs.
Yeah.
I'm not a professional cricketer for my whole life, whether it's your father, your boss, your headmaster, whoever it is tells you to do something, you have enough respect for their position and their authority that you do it.
Yep.
And you do it as you're asked, on time. And in this situation, the team was battling. Not battling necessarily on the field. We were getting, you know, a pretty solid humping.
Yeah.
Don't get me wrong, but we were competitive.
Yep.
We had our chances in Chennai, and Dhoni played a beautiful innings. Hyderabad, you know, we picked the wrong team. Lyon was left out, and we had Maxwell and Xavier Doherty as our two spinners. We didn't get out-batted, we actually got outspun.
Yeah.
So we're 2-0 down, but things had crept into the team. Discipline issues of little things that people think, that doesn't make a difference, but it does. When you're spending every day with the same people, if it becomes an acceptable behaviour to be 5 minutes late for training and nothing's said, then the next day two people are late for training, the next day three, and all of a sudden the whole team's late. And the cycle starts breaking down of this is a highly elite team that is needs certain aspects of discipline to perform at an elite level. And they had kind of started, they had broken down.
Mm.
And there was, you know, some issues obviously between Michael and Shane and, you know, different personalities. But casting that all aside, because I don't think that is at the crux of the story. The crux of the story was the team needed someone to kick it up the arse, basically. And, you know, even little things like people being rude to Indian waiters, which other people were finding inappropriate.
Yeah.
And would say something, and then there'd be a little bit of bickering. You know, so the team wasn't a rock-solid team, and the boss of that team asked someone, or everyone, one simple question. How is this team getting better, and how are you contributing to that? Very, very simple. And it wasn't home, you know, the media love making the headline.
Yep.
It was, grab me for a coffee, slip a note under my door, send me a text, have a game of golf with me. I don't really care how this is conveyed to me,
yep,
but I want to know from you, to make you accountable to me, to your teammates, the captain, and everyone in this room, how is this team getting better, and how are you helping? So I took it seriously. If someone in that position of authority asks you to do something, you do it, and you do it on time. And people didn't take it seriously. That's kind of where the team was at.
Yeah.
And, you know, Mickey's reaction, was it appropriate? It's hard to gauge. Suspending people from the team was probably the only way that he could get the attention that yep. he was trying to command, because if it was, you know, $100 fine, you know, these guys are well paid.
Yeah.
$100 fine here for turning up late.
It's a parking fine.
It's a parking fine.
Yeah.
So what is the only way I can grab their attention and show them that I mean business? And he did what he believed in. And to this day, I don't know whether it was the right decision, but I support that he took a stand because something needed to happen.
He lost the fight though, didn't he?
He did. He got executed. Absolutely.
The weird thing was the captain went in and said, yeah, we're right behind him.
Well, he was. I think, yeah. Don't get me wrong, I think Michael was certainly at the heart with Mickey of ensuring that the team got back on track. And I don't know whose suggestion it was in terms of the ultimate penalty. But to be honest, I think most of the players in the group at the time thought it was appropriate.
Yeah.
It's very easy to sit back afterwards after Mickey had gone and everything had, you know, the media had blown it up. But when we sat in that room and
four of them who didn't...
I think there were four.
Participate, yeah.
When it got told to us, and I remember it vividly, Mahali, you know, there were people in tears, upset.
People were crying.
Absolutely.
The
people who'd been left out.
Yeah.
It meant so much to them that they'd been left out or unavailable. And it actually brought the team closer together. And I maintain that to this day, that the people that made the mistake knew at that point they made a mistake. And the rest of the team knew what the standard was from there on. As it turned out, the test in Mahali was by far and away our best test match.
Mm.
So something happened that twigged, and I think if Mickey had been able to play that out a little bit longer, it's very easy to say, oh, you know, we lost the Ashes but won it back, and, you know, but Mitchell Johnson and Brad Haddon essentially won the Ashes back 5-0.
Sure.
Would have Mickey been able to produce those results? Who knows? My guess is to say anyone could have coached Mitchell Johnson in that series. But, you know, history is history.
Did the future management reap the benefits of that?
Yeah, I think so, to a degree.
Yeah.
To a degree.
I want to take you back to when you first started playing cricket. Was there a point where you thought, hey, I could probably do this for a living? As a teenager or something, you thought, you know, because I think most kids have the dream that they want to, if they're into sport, they want to represent Australia.
I had the dream, and it burnt deeply. You know, I wanted to do that, but I wasn't one of those kids that was ever... I never thought of myself as super talented, even though I was, you know...
Must have been making some runs. You played under 17s, 19s,
the full bit, and you don't realise when you're... I never thought that was the pathway that had been cut out for me, because... Yeah. I always felt I was up against it. I had someone to prove wrong. It was a bit unfashionable to go to a good school and try and play cricket in New South Wales at the time. So I always felt like I was a little bit on a road that hadn't been travelled particularly well. And New South Wales at the time, you know, there was, and the system was very different, no rookies, but Stephen Mark Waugh was still playing. You know, those last couple of years of Shield cricket, Michael Bevan was still around, Michael Slater, all these guys. So I was like, there's no way, I wasn't thinking in 5 years' time I could be in that team. I was thinking, am I good enough to be in this team now as a 19-year-old? The answer was no. Yeah. Of course the answer was no.
But you were like, oh, I can still keep playing cricket. Let's just see where this goes.
That's exactly. So at 16, 17, 18, 19, as a guy that had obviously been earmarked, but I didn't quite see it as that. I just thought I'd earned my selection in all these teams.
But you must have in the back of your mind been thinking, I want to play for Australia. Absolutely. Like, no, if you don't have that belief and that desire, you're not going to
Drive, as I said, don't confuse the drive. Yeah.
Wouldn't throw away your Saturdays.
That's right. Don't confuse me not being incredibly driven to the point of obsession with, so that's me wanting to do it, but not necessarily knowing that it was going to happen. There was, you know, some people feel as though it's preordained that they are going to play cricket for Australia. I never, ever, ever felt that that was even the case for New South Wales. You know, at 19, I'd score 1,000 grade runs to get a look into the second 11 team.
Yeah.
Had to score a certain amount of runs to even get a rookie contract in the, and I kept seeing people being, you know, what I would see given opportunities. So I was at uni, you know, I was like, well, if cricket works out, what a gig, but I'm going to sort my life out in the meantime. And as it turned out, I was working, my first contract with New South Wales, I was working a full-time job anyway. So, and then I'd try and balance both. And even at that point, it took for my boss to say, mate, you need to go and follow this cricket dream a bit more because...
Good boss.
Yeah. He said, you can do this any, you can, if it doesn't work out, knock on my door.
Have a job for it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Go and follow this a bit harder. So...
You touched on there is an interesting line about it being unfashionable to be... from a good school in the cricket community, and I think you've made a comment that gets quoted a lot about just to paraphrase the sort of burden of privilege in the cricket community that you've seen as soft, that people don't necessarily respect you, and I'm sure they do now, but you had to earn it. Can you tell me how that manifested itself when you were coming through the New South Wales
good question
system?
I think it,
whether it's tangible, it's little things here or there.
I think part of it was tangible. I think, you know, it was still a bit of a bullying culture, I think, of young upstarts.
Yep.
They'd never really had a rookie program, so they'd never really had young guys around the squad. It was very old school.
And you're there to take their job.
No, exactly. So they're probably viewing it with a little bit of suspicion as well. But, you know, luckily, there were some fantastic people in the squad. Greg Mayle...
But you didn't. Did you feel like it was like? Were you? Was it? I read Dean Jones's some of Dean Jones's account. And he was being bullied when he was coming through as a teenager.
I think it's a pretty common story. You talk to Mike Hussey and he'd say the same thing. He got badly bullied in the WA squad as a young player, and it was just the culture.
Yeah,
and it took some shifting from a few of those sort of middle-aged players becoming the senior players. And making a genuine effort to change how young players were brought into these squads. And now they get bloody open arms and cuddles, which is fantastic and how it should be.
Do you find it funny that in almost any other profession, your upbringing would have resulted in you being in the sort of inner sanctum or having, you know, a coattails ride through?
Yeah, I think I made a similar comment in my book that every other profession provides, rightly or wrongly, some kind of inner sanctum, and all of a sudden you're the outsider trying to play cricket.
And I recognise the irony of two privileged white males.
I know, sitting here.
Having a big moan over a cup of tea.
I know, exactly. In an inner city suburb. But I guess the overarching point is that I did feel like an outsider, and I always felt like I had to prove someone wrong, that I was being judged, and I was permanently on this kind of guard up, and probably didn't let that guard down maybe until I went down to Tassie and sort of found myself as a person, as a cricketer, and reaped the benefits of that on the field. And then having come back to New South Wales, I feel as though I'm a completely different person.
A short break. I hope you're enjoying this interview with Ed Cowan. If you want to hear some more interviews, we've got some fantastic guests coming up. Make sure you subscribe to The Stack Report. Do us a big favour. Go on iTunes, leave us a rating, leave us a review. That stuff will really help us. It's not like we're making you pay for this. It's the least you can do. Come on, it's going to take you like 20 seconds. Anyway, back to Ed Cowan.
For those who don't know, why'd you leave New South Wales, you know, to go to Tasmania at the time, which wasn't a sexier destination as perhaps it is now?
A couple of factors at play. One, I'd been very well looked after by New South Wales, to their credit, but I'd sort of got to a point where I'd been injured for a year. I had a really bad foot injury that kept me out for a year. And in that year, Phil Hughes came and essentially took my spot.
He went all right, didn't he?
And the kid could play. So I sort of felt as though, you know, having busted my balls to get to the top of the pecking order in New South Wales as that batsman, that I'd fallen down to not just one out of the team, I'd fallen to five or six out of the team. And I couldn't quite, rightly or wrongly, see the light that was ever going to be I just didn't have the energy to fight again. I felt as though the opportunity to go down there and, you know, maybe my experience as the outsider for a lot of years, I thought, bugger it, I'll go create my own identity. They don't know what school I went to, who I'm friends with.
Okay.
You know, what my cricket history is, etc., etc. I'll go do my own thing and create my own narrative. And found some great people to help out down there. But Michael DiVenuto is the batting coach, and I think he'll prove to be the best batting coach in the world, and he probably is at the moment. So he was the batting coach, and I thought, what a great opportunity.
Yeah.
And they were winning. They had a great culture. You know, I was mates with George Bailey, who was the captain already. It just seemed a perfect fit. And it was an agonising decision. But in the end, when I could clear my head, it was an easy decision. And when I did it, it was just a bit of an open sea to set sail on.
How'd you find Tassie as a place to live?
I loved it. Yeah. Having grown up in Sydney and inner city Sydney, it was just
What about as a life as a cricketer? I noticed in your book you talk about how Sydney's a very big place and you don't really hang out with each other, and you're very, you know, separate, and in Tassie you're all sort of there together.
Yeah. Oh, I think that plays a massive part on the culture of the team. And they play that up rightly to suit the cricket program down there. So as a place to live, I loved it. My wife loves the warm weather, so she felt that it wasn't necessarily
they get a lot of the say, don't
naturally
they?
That conducive to her happiness, and it's very easy. You know, I slip in with 20 blokes who love playing cricket, and you know, have a natural friendship group. It's a lot harder for the other half.
Cricket
widow is just an absolute trooper, and has. Yeah, I wouldn't have been able to do what I've done without her constantly pushing and being supportive in the way she is. But so, made some great friends in cricket down there, outside of cricket, met some fantastic people. It's a great town, and it grew. The town grew a lot while we were down there. You know, it sort of boomed in the foodie.
Might have been your influence. You're a bit of a hipster, aren't you?
Absolutely, like, yeah.
Well, love the oysters down there.
I should should clip the ticket from Tourism Tasmania with their 10% growth year on year since I first arrived. What a great correlation.
Responsible for ruining Bruny Island, I'm told. No one could get in there now.
Very good. Very tickets.
Tell me about, you wrote about in your book about the concept of the black swan. And I find that particularly interesting regarding your sort of time at Tasmania and how you seem to have a lot of success there. Tell me about the idea of the black swan.
Jeez. In any particular, I was fascinated with Nassim Taleb's book, The Black Swan, mainly from an economics and finance point of view. But, you know, I think it relates to cricket. Well, the whole randomness and, you know, what we would call luck.
You and I have talked about this previously off air. I think it's an astonishingly lucky sport.
Oh, and we don't. Why don't we acknowledge it? Well, someone asked me today in regards to this season. Geez, you played well in the second half of the year. I said, well, I don't think so. I think I played equally as well in the first half, but I had a bit more luck. I had an LBW decision turned down when I was on five at the MCG. I got dropped six ball in the same innings, and you go on to make 200, and that turns your season around.
Ask,
you
know, Peter Hanscom, similar situation to see him get in the test side, right?
That's at the SCG, yeah. Exactly, yeah. Right. And we don't...
Dropped twice before 70 or something, makes a double 100, and now he's playing test cricket.
We concentrate on the outcomes, and this concept, it wasn't new to me, but you know, he just put it in a great way of actually identifying those moments and sort of... it's almost as though once you kind of open your mind to the world of randomness and luck, then the game's a lot easier to play. You get a lot less upset when you get out. You probably don't ride the high of scoring runs like you do. So you kind of just end up on this even keel of, you know, it's a game. Moments happen out of your control, in your control, yes, but some are out of your control that really determine the course of your career. And I've had multiple moments, and we don't acknowledge them for whatever reason. And George Bailey,
when it's too early for weak people to blame things on luck. That's why strong people don't acknowledge it.
I think you're probably right.
You're big on team. You guys won the Shield while you were down there, Sheffield Shield. That's
probably my happiest moment of
that's exactly
cricket.
What I was going to ask.
More so than that moment of being presented Baggy Green, very nice personal kind of relief, I guess, actually, of all the people that poured their time and energy into me now have some kind of vindication, or more so than
and
any
tolerated
100.
Your missing weddings.
Exactly,
and
all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But that moment of winning the Shield with guys that, you know, it'd been a 9-month dream from the moment you turn up day one pre-season, and I'm sure you hear it's the closest cricketers get to that AFL premiership kind of apex of the season. And winning test matches is phenomenal. That's great fun, but you know, the team's chopping and changing. Changing formats. You don't know a few people in the team that well at stages. It's only a 3-test series, but over 10 games plus a final, you are the best team. Regardless of the level of competition, it's the same what the club cricketer experiences on the weekends if they get to win a grand final. It's just a phenomenal feeling of mutual and shared moments that, you know, in 10 years' time you can come back and talk about. That same experience that you shared with one of your friends, or someone that you weren't friends with at the start of the season but you're now tight with.
Yeah.
Or someone you're still not friends with but you had those fantastic partnerships that won the game for the team. Mm. And that's your shared experience. That, to me, is why I play. And you know, we've just finished a Shield season where we missed out by six runs over the course of the season, and I've gone through every one of my innings in my own mind and thought, could I've got another 6 runs at something? You know, I know it's...
I'll give you the tip. You've made 900. You've got made more runs than anyone else in Shield. I don't know that you could have got another 6 runs.
I'm sure I had another 6 runs in that run chase. You know, like, what? Agonising for that moment of an opportunity to win another Shield, and that is... And the game changes as well. Maybe it's because it's where I'm at in my career, but to share that moment of even 100 partnership or 200 partnership, or seeing someone get 5 for, or winning a game or a Shield, that gives me so much more enjoyment than, you know, that personal milestone. That personal milestone is only a contribution to the team winning.
When I was in WA, starting as a young sports reporter, I was blown away. I don't know whether it's a Perth road trip thing or whatever, I think the Perth side were a bit wild at the time. I was blown away by how much the state cricketers would go out on the drink, even during Shield games.
Yeah, they had a bad culture in the West.
Oh, but the other I'd see other teams out as well from other
maybe
states.
You're probably right. It's probably a cricket thing.
You guys didn't drink really for that whole season where you guys won the Shield.
Yeah. No, we kind of made a bit of a pact to each other, actually.
So my question is, how big was the celebrations when you finally got it done?
It was massive. It was massive. I've still got a photo of me sitting in my whites. So I haven't been home, haven't changed. George Bailey, who's got
how many
the Energizer Bunny. Well, so this is 4 o'clock the next day.
In the afternoon.
In the afternoon, sitting in a pub with my hat on, medal around my neck, and finally I was just like, I can't keep my eyes open, this is ridiculous.
Yeah.
And George Bailey, who has more energy, is the energizer bunny when it comes to celebrating victories. He was still going 2 days later. It was phenomenal. But just the pure emotion just carried us through for a good solid sort of 24 hours.
Speaking of pure emotion, the next summer you get picked to play Test cricket for Australia. What do you remember of being called up? What do you remember of your cap presentation, your first games at the MCG on Boxing Day? You make runs. Give me the whole experience.
I think before I get to that, while just going back to the issue of luck, that season, people don't realise that I could not buy a run. For the first 4 weeks of the summer, I was basically going to be dropped from the Tassie team before I got the first 100 of the 4 that I got that got me in the Test team.
Yep.
I was gone for all money. And we played a one-day game, and a friend had passed away, and you know, I was quite emotional, you know, and scored some runs, got 100.
That doesn't get a run in the book.
I think it probably does. You probably maybe fell asleep that chapter.
Skimmed through,
yeah,
maybe.
That's right. But four, you know, 400s later in the Test team, and that 400 is only 3 weeks. So you're going from on your ass to in the Test team in 3 weeks.
Wow.
But to get back to the question, you know, I've got some key memories. One is, you know, the phone call from Invers. When I was down in Canberra, it was just phenomenal. And then lying in bed that night, you know, the daydreaming starts. The cap presentation was phenomenal.
Dean Jones?
It was Dino. So the manager, Gavin, who's a fantastic fella, said, who would you like if you could pick anyone? Yeah. I said, I would love Slats. Slats was one of my heroes growing up. Ricky Ponting and Michael Slater. He said, Slats presented Dave Warner's 2 weeks ago, so we can't get Slats back, but I'll have a thing. Anyway, it was a surprise, and it was Dino, who was, it was fantastic. Boxing Day, I was meant to be at my mate's Bucks party.
Yeah, that's right.
At the cricket.
So they were sitting in the stands watching you.
They were, yeah. So I had a ticket booked as well, so I was meant to be watching the Test match in the stands at my best mate's Bucks Day. So all my mates were there anyway. My family were there. People had flown in. Win the toss, bat. And my record at the MCG at the time was horrific. Couldn't buy a run there. Tricky, bit of a tricky wicket. Overcast day. I was so nervous. I think we won the toss.
You look pained saying you're nervous now.
From memory, I'm pretty sure I threw up maybe 2 or 3 times. And then, you know, people forget opening the batting. So you've been presenting your bag of green, you probably shed a tear. There's 45,000 people when the national anthem's being played. You've got your pads on, you're sort of holding back. So the whole emotional build-up isn't just
so foreign.
That first ball. So foreign. I've never stood there and sang the national anthem in front of 45,000 people before going out to face a ball and trying to control your emotions. And, you know, cricket's about being zen and relaxed and, you know, being excited by the moment but just embracing it as well. If you're too pumped up, big cover drive on your ass. So I'm trying to control all you know, these foreign kind of emotions, as you say. And then that first ball, if it was straight, would have got me out for sure. So here's a hit card by this beautiful outswinger that I left. And I thought, oh. And it was perfect outswinger. If it was 2 stumps straight, I probably would have left and it would have bowled me. But that sighter, you know, I got a bit of a sighter and all of a sudden, it might have been 2 or 3 balls in. I thought, you know what? This is just cricket. You know, like, you lose track of the crowd, it's a bit of a white noise, you don't see them, you don't hear them because it's just a general sort of hum or buzz, and you've got this big sight screen and there's the bowler running in, and it doesn't matter if you're at the MCG or Sydney Uni number one, it's the same game. And I thought, I can do this. I've done this for years.
Yeah.
We're away here, and I was just, you know, in my own little world for maybe, we were on and off with rain, for 2 hours maybe, and I looked up and there was this one moment I remember, and Ponting was at the other end, my childhood hero. You know, so Ricky Ponting's batting at the other end, this is ridiculous. You know, he's telling me to watch the ball, giving me glove punches. The crowd when he got to 50 absolutely erupted, And I was at the other end. I was, I'm going to just pop out of my bubble for a second. I'm going to look around. I'm going to soak this up and take a little memory photograph.
Yep.
And just snap it. I'm going to do a full 360 of the Coliseum and snap it so I never forget this moment after Ricky Ponting just scored 50. And I just stood there like, this is unbelievable. Oh, no, you don't want this to end. And then I actually managed to sort of get back in my bubble and bat for a bit longer. But it, so I remember that moment. And then the actual cricket, I can't remember a shot that I played or that he played.
Do you remember your emotion walking off? Were you proud that you'd scored runs? Were you livid that you'd missed the opportunity to score 100 under Boo? Or?
I think the pride came probably when I got 50. I was like, you know what? You haven't disgraced yourself.
Far from it.
You know, you've batted for 4 hours or whatever. But walking up, so I was furious because no DRS against India and I got given out caught behind and I hadn't nicked it.
You didn't hit it?
No, not even close. And like, and I'm a big not outer. Like, I'm never out.
Yeah,
but on this occasion, I wasn't out. You know, there's video there is video evidence to suggest that there is a big gap between the edge of my bat and the ball. So I was thinking, bloody hell. Test cricket and the umpires are still bloody rubbish.
Very good. You enjoyed some real success. One test hundred, against South Africa at the Gabba. A world class attack, a fast attack.
Mm.
Is that the innings that you enjoyed most? Is it the most you're the most proud of? Did it feel like a look, everyone, I can do it.
Yeah, I think more than anything. You know, it was obviously played with. You don't get Test 100 and not play well, particularly against that attack on, you know, at the Gabba that suits their bowlers. I was proud that I'd managed to play well, but it was more, I came into the Test under massive pressure. As I said earlier in the podcast, I've had a terrible tour of the West Indies in really tough circumstances, and the West Indies is a tour that people don't really watch. The time zone is terrible, but they see the scorecard. And, you know, we had balls rolling, spitting over our heads. You know, it was a tough tour. Ponting, Hussey, Clark. No one scored any runs. But because I hadn't...
When you're in the gun, you're in the
gun. When you're in the gun, you're in the gun.
And I know it from a journo's perspective. Yeah. It's like there's like a list. And if you're at the top of the list in terms of this guy needs to get runs, that's all that matters.
I was at the top of that list.
If you're a second on the list, you're okay. Because you are going to be on top of the list eventually.
That's exactly right. Yeah. If the other bloke...
And it works the other way as well.
Oh, of course.
If, you know, when line for selection.
I get the ebbs and the flows. But at this point in time, I was top of the list. Seven tests, hadn't scored 100, coming off a pretty crappy tour against the world's number one team. The build-up was phenomenal. And it was just that moment of, you know... Suck it, I did it. You know, like there's so much press around last test. This is his last test, last chance. And not that you're reading it, but you get the general vibe pretty quickly.
Yeah.
You know, when every interview starts with, you really need some runs this test match, you're like, yeah, that would be nice. So I think the overriding emotion was relief, was... This party can go on for a bit longer now.
Yep.
You know, I'm having so much fun. I just don't want it to end. Part of the emotion was, thank God, you know, other people will now think I'm good enough. I've played enough cricket even in the last seven tests to know that I'm good enough. Because if you get 50 or 60 or 70 in a test match, you're good enough.
Mm.
But for whatever reason, people love hundreds. It's only the difference between 70 and 100 is only 30 runs for the team. Could be 30 leg bars. Who cares what it is for the team?
You're big on stats. There being a misappropriation of stats in cricket, aren't you?
I am. That can be the next question. But that was so for me. That moment of you guys can now think I've known that I'm good enough, and you can get off my back for a bit.
What's it like? I'll get to the stats, but what's it like facing rapid bowling? Brett Lee, Dale Steyn, Mitchell Johnson. Is it as terrifying as mortals like myself think, or is it exhilarating?
It's exhilarating.
As
an opening batsman who's trained in the fine art of facing fast bowling, I think it's just...
So that doesn't scare you, Dale Steyn steaming in at 150?
Not even in the what's the worst that can happen? You know,
well, worst that happens.
We know what the worst that can happen is, sadly, now.
But not to be flippant about it. But I mean, Sean Tate basically broke your toe, didn't he, at the SCG? A
couple of times.
Yeah.
But you know, I was just thinking about the contest and the challenge, and Dale Steyn, great fast bowler. It's a bit different. They've got a bit of an awkward action, but someone like a Brett Lee or a Dale Steyn, you see the ball out of the hand. Like, it's coming at you quickly, but you see it all the way. I'd take Dale Steyn over Mornay Morkel every day of the week. And that's Mornay at his peak. He's not bowling as fast as he used to. But when he was bowling fast, holy smokes. Like, how you ever meant to score off a ball that's trampolining up, rib height off a length? You can't drive him. You can't cut him. You kind of hope that he drifts onto your pads. You know, where Dale Steyn, he's so good, you kind of know what it, you've seen it all before.
Yeah.
I've seen these tricks before, mate. For your 350 test wickets, you're going to try and swing one down the line, bounce me out after a while, and, you know, eventually you'll try and nip a couple across. You know, you've almost lived it through your own eyes watching him on TV. So, you know, there's no secrets, I guess, but it is coming fast. There's no doubt about that, and that team, that South African team, was phenomenal because everyone had different skills that kept coming at you.
Yeah. You guys succeeded there. You failed in England in that Ashes series. Watching that on television, that looked tough. Can you just talk to me about... It must be one thing to succeed on an international scale, to fail like that. Mm. How it must be character building. How do you deal with it? You're going out to walking out to bat just knowing that you're nowhere near the level you want to be at.
Yeah.
What's it like?
So obviously I only played that one test in Nottingham. And it was an absolute corker of a test. You know, England won by 12 runs.
Yeah.
Ashton Agar, you know, obviously first innings heroics. Hughesy played beautifully.
The ball was swinging and seaming.
Yeah, it was. I actually didn't see a lot of the test. I was crook. Like, really crook, heading the base. And
that's right, I remember.
Crook. So I don't remember a lot about that test match. So I never really felt that I contributed at all. I didn't contribute with the bat, but I don't feel like I contributed even in supporting the guys in the chain room because I wasn't at the ground a lot. But the vibe of the series was, when we turned up, we're going to win. And then when we came 12 runs so close at Trent Bridge, we still thought we were going to win.
Mm.
It wasn't probably until Lord's, that second test, and I wasn't in the team, but, you know, I was a pretty close onlooker running the drinks when they, I don't like the word doctored, but they certainly produced a wicket that suited Graham Swatton, and we got spun out badly.
Yeah.
2-0 down, you're gone.
Yeah.
And then, you know, we won Manchester, Durham, hang on, we're a chance here, and then Broad pulls a rabbit out of a hat and bowls amazingly well. So we felt like the scoreline 3-1 didn't really do us justice of that tour. I gave very little on the field. And by the end of a tour like that, if you're not playing, it's pretty hard to stay really emotionally involved in the series. You kind of have to keep an arm's length because you're not playing. It's a bloody long tour.
Yeah.
You're not playing any cricket. There's no tour. It's not like the old days where there are four or five tour games to keep your interest levels up. So it was actually mentally a very hard tour to be on. It was something that, you know, I think from my own personal journey, if I hadn't gone and failed and been dropped, then I wouldn't be the cricketer that I'm today.
Mm.
You know, I feel like I'm a much better cricketer now, and that's just part of my personal journey, I guess.
Do you think you'd be playing Test cricket if it was a different coaching setup?
Oh, that's a good question. I definitely think if I would have been given a bit more of a run during the Ashes.
During that particular series?
During that particular series. I don't know about now. I think, you know, the destiny would have been created by how many runs I'd scored, but sure. I don't think I would have had a new coach, one test in which I was not just... had the flu like I have now, head in the bowl, injections to stop throwing up, sick. I think another coach, another regime, I probably would have had a few more tests.
Is it almost is there a gap there between the way the two of you approach your cricket? Like, Darren's has a history of being alpha, aggressive sort of coach. You know.
Yeah, I think particularly. I mean, back to the personal journey about it. If I had, I'd become a bit of a caricature of myself. You know, I'd always been an attacking batsman growing up. Yeah, even my best shield innings had been attacking innings.
Yeah, your book, you said you were a dasher as a young guy.
Absolutely,
I was like, really?
Yeah, absolutely. And still, my job, and it had been sort of ingrained in me, was to face as many balls in this team. Tester, you protect Michael Clarke, you protect Michael Hussey, Ricky Ponting, to the best that you can do.
Real openers, as Richard Hines says.
Real openers, exactly. 100 balls. Can you do 150 balls? We don't care if you're 30. And I took, I was like, okay, I'm going to take some pride in this as my job. And it kind of, if I had my time again, I probably would have said, I kind of get what you're saying, but I'm going to do it the best way that I see fit, which probably would have been to try and put a bit more pressure on the bowlers. So as it turned out, I got dropped probably for being a bit too defensive because I wasn't scoring. I was facing a lot of balls, but not scoring. Eventually, the game's determined by how many runs you get. If I hadn't been through that and had them say, we want you to play a bit more positively, I don't think I wouldn't have changed how I was playing, and then I wouldn't have been playing the last three seasons how I played. So it's that journey of, in the long run, I wish I was 25 when it happened rather than 30, because I'm now a much better player having been through that and gone through that whole exercise.
Chris Rogers talked about being relieved to being dropped from the national team at times, and talked about being relieved about the journey being over because the intensity and the pressure of playing for Australia, that's not something that is appropriate to you or relevant to you.
I get what he's saying. Yeah. I struggled with the intensity is one way of putting it, but just the narrow-mindedness of this is cricket all year round. Now, domestic cricket's nice because you get a little bit of a break and then you have a bit of a pre-season. But this is tour after tour. I think for one of the years that I was in the test, I had 12 days in my own bed. So I have great admiration for a Steve Smith or a David Warner. They can single-mindedly dedicate themselves to their cricket so strategically and give themselves so fully to it for so long. Mm. So when I got dropped, I was absolutely devastated because I felt, aggrieved on a whole, and I'm kind of over that aspect. But, the dream felt over, yes, so you have to deal with that. But part of me, there was a bit of a relief that you can kind of be a bit normal, because if you are living in the world of an Australian cricketer, it is not the real world. It is not even close to the real world. And the attitudes that you deal with in that team to the real world are so far removed from how they should be. Because people become accustomed to being an Australian cricketer. They live in the bubble of being on tour permanently. There is no other sport, team sport, like tennis and golfers.
Baseball,
but they have a pretty solid off-season as well. Yeah. So it's unique in that sense. So I think Chris sums it up nicely, that when you do decompress and you come out of the bubble, you kind of are thankful that the real world's they're waiting for you, I guess, because it's such a strange and foreign world that you can't prepare for going into that bubble, and it's nice to come out of it. It's hard, and when you're in it, it's very hard to chop and change between the two.
You haven't given up, have you, on going back in to the bubble? Because you just finished a season where you top scored Sheffield Shield runs, 959 at 73. I imagine that's your best Sheffield Shield season.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
You're 34. I feel like youth is in vogue with the national team at the moment.
Well spotted, yeah.
That's why they pay me the big dollars, Ed. But have you given up?
No. I think the realist in me thinks it's done. Mm. And maybe that's created this kind of cricketer that is playing how he is. But part of me thinks, you know what?
Chris Rogers, Adam
Sure,
Rogers.
Yeah, but not only that. Sure, I'm the same age as Sean Marsh.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, 50 off 200 balls from a 34-year-old is back in vogue in India. I'm thinking, hang on.
From a lefty.
From a left-handed batsman. And it was It was brilliant to watch. So I think the realist in me thinks it's done, mate. But would I do it again? Of course. Of course. Would I like to play cricket for Australia again? Of course. That's why I turn up to... You turn up to training to get better. Mm. To get better so you are the person that wins the game for your team and your team wins. If you get the opportunity to test yourself to see how good you are in the Australian team, of course you do it. But do I go to bed dreaming about it like I did? No.
Mm. We're running out of time rapidly. There's so much more I wanted to talk to you about. I might just try and touch on the future of Australian cricket. Because I think you've probably got some interesting perspectives on this for a guy who's played so much at the level just below the national side.
Yeah.
Do you have concerns for the health of the game in Australia? Because it seems to me, watching this last summer, and it might have already been like this, but I felt that this was a real watershed summer, that the Big Bash League was the
ticket
most important
town.
Thing.
It was the ticket in town, wasn't it?
To Cricket Australia. And they're clever. Yeah. It's clever that they have set themselves up where that will ensure they are financially strong enough to endure bad test summers.
Yeah.
But was that your read of it? And is it a good thing that that's the case?
Yeah. It's certainly the read of it when the Adelaide Strikers pack out week in, week out for 8 weeks. They get 55,000 people there and a one-day international gets 24.
Yeah.
4 weeks later. You kind of think everyone's spent their cookies on the Big Bash. I think there's so many issues at play here. One, from a talent point of view, Australia's cricket's is fine. You know, okay. Whether it's Test matches, T20, we have a huge talent pool of domestic cricketers that are good enough to play Test cricket. How they are managed, though, and how their skills are funneled is going to be the challenge. So can someone on, you know, who has a huge incentive to be good at T20 cricket, huge incentive.
Yeah.
That's now half a domestic player's wage.
Yep.
Can they be a great test player? My gut feeling says no.
And I feel like the next generation as well will be...
It's only going to increase.
Yeah, like there's this attitude that like, no, test cricket's still the pinnacle. Yeah, it is for our generation, you, me, for a guy who's David Warner's age, maybe even Matt Renshaw, let's say, who's 20.
Yeah.
But the next one coming through who are 10 and 12, like my nephew is 11, loves the Big Bash League. He loves test cricket as well, but he will watch the game and then watch the repeat the next morning. He probably, if he ever becomes a superstar cricketer, unlikely with our genes, but surely T20, these kids are going to just want to play that.
Of course. It's almost a bit of a no-brainer of a conversation. Not only are they watching it, but they're playing it. So yeah. The entry-level cricket, and so it should be, is T20. But all of a sudden, the kids, when they get to 12... Oh no, we've been playing T20 in the under 10s. That's what I want to play at under 12, under 4. When do you start introducing serious cricket? Where, and how far along that learning sort of timeline do you have to say, well, actually, we need to learn how not to just hit the ball out of the ground? You know, we need some. So it's going to be the skill is going to be involved in teaching people that good T20 cricket, the fundamentals still come from cricket, whether that's one day international or, you know, long form cricket, the technical aspects, but that's at the moment. In 10 years time, that's going to change drastically. People are going to be, you know, doing things that we aren't even dreaming of yet, and so the game's actually going to get further and further apart. We've seen at the moment, because it's our generation at the moment play both formats, that T20 cricket and test cricket kind of, you know, a lot of skills kind of merge into each other, and we see scoring rates in test cricket increase because of it. But if people start only learning how to play T20 cricket, the skill of T20 and test cricket, they actually become further apart. There'll be an inflection point where it falls off the cliff and the two games are so far apart from each other, it's not funny.
Mm. In your book, you were talking about how you were being left out of the Tassie's T20 side. And you saw yourself as being a real contributor to T20. You didn't even bother to play in the Big Bash League.
Yeah.
I reckon that was... I'm sure you could have got a game or as squad selection. Why make that decision?
It came down to a pretty simple analysis of, after every Big Bash, how has my Shield season finished? Every time I've played in the Big Bash, I've been an absolute fizzler after the Big Bash. So, you know, start of the season well, done really well, Big Bash, come in, no runs.
And you train too finished, hard, or a lot of games on the road?
I think it's a mentally and physically very demanding schedule.
Yeah.
A lot of travel. But for me, my technique for T20 and long form are miles apart.
Okay.
So to then have 4 days after the Big Bash to say, well, there's a Shield game in 4 days' time, it probably takes me 3 weeks to get back to where I was, and you've played 3 Shield games, there are 2 left. So I was like, you know, bugger it. What do I enjoy more? I enjoy watching the Big Bash. Do I enjoy playing it? I enjoy the crowd, but I'm not great at it. I can contribute, and there'd be a job for me if I put my hand up and said I want a job. But I could either play Shield cricket for 3 years and be really good at it and contribute there, or I can try and play as much cricket, you know, as you can possibly can, and try and milk the cow, try and earn as much money. I thought, I'd rather be really good at Shield cricket for 2 or 3 years.
There's not a temptation there, as I say, you're no doubt closer to the end of your career than the beginning, to make some money and set yourself up.
There's always a temptation, but I have a conversation with myself that I've had a few times in my career. Why did you start playing the game? And I've never played for money. Not that you would play for free, because there's obviously an opportunity cost involved. Yep. But if, you know, money has never been a factor in any decision that I've ever made based on cricket. So why would this now be a factor?
I think that's probably a good spot to end. I wanted to talk about your time playing in the Netherlands, playing county cricket. I wanted to ask you about a whole heap of other things. Your views on stats, might have to save it all for another time.
If anyone manages to listen here, Patrick, and I'm sure they will, because you have a big sway with some big people, maybe you'll ask me back at some stage.
If you'll come back, we'd love to have you.
Thanks, mate.
Thanks very much.
Thanks.
That's the end of our interview with Ed Cowan. Thanks so much for listening to the Stack Report. Make sure you tune in. Well, you can't really tune in. Make sure you subscribe on iTunes. We're on Wooshka as well. And, you know, get your fill. Interesting sports people. We're going to give you interviews with them. Won't cost you anything. Just throw us a review. How hard is that? Cheers. Bye.